This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a reset in U.S.-Latin American relations. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Regional analysts say that the Biden-Harris administration faces unique challenges and opportunities as it seeks to reverse some Trump policies on migration, address the political and economic crisis in Venezuela, and confronts growing Chinese and Russian influence in Latin America. The Trump administration's approach to Latin America, say many regional analysts, consisted of inhumane migration policies and the empowering of authoritarians like President Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil. The Biden administration has indicated that it will seek to change both the tone and substance of U.S. policy toward its neighbors to the south. With regard to democracy, we recall that in 2019, activists took to the streets throughout Latin America, pressing for economic equality, free and fair elections, and an end to corruption. According to the Sufan Center, a New York-based policy group, quote, the region witnessed several corruption scandals, and transnational criminal organizations and narco trafficking continued to make the region more insecure as institutions to protect against them are growing weaker. U.S. national security and domestic policy are interconnected with the stability and prosperity of neighbors to the south, particularly around the U.S.-Mexico border, close quote. In that vein, U.S. President Joe Biden said he is committed to addressing the root causes of forced migration from the Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Endemic corruption, lack of economic opportunity, and gang and militia violence are precipitating another surge of unaccompanied migrant children at the U.S.-Mexico border. According to the New York Times, Roberta Jacobson, special assistant to President Biden overseeing border issues, announced a program that allows children in Central America to apply for protection in the region and avoid making the dangerous journey north to join parents already in the United States. That program and a $4 billion investment in Central America are seen as crucial tools by the Biden administration to address the poverty, persecution, and corruption that have driven vulnerable families to seek refuge in the United States. Elsewhere, the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated and strained the precarious health infrastructure and deteriorating economies of the region, especially in Venezuela and Brazil. How will the Biden-Harris team tackle the ongoing political, economic, and humanitarian crisis in Venezuela? The Sufan Center asserts that Venezuela may be one of the few areas in which the views of both the Trump and Biden administrations align, including denunciation of the current Maduro regime as illegitimate and support for restoring democracy under interim President Juan Guaido. In a recent article, Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and Council of the Americas, one of our Encounter panelists, writes that Venezuela today stands alone as the worst humanitarian disaster in the modern history of Latin America. He says that almost 20%, between 5 and 6 million people of Venezuela's entire pre-crisis population has fled the country, spawning a refugee crisis in neighboring countries. Well, for more on how the Biden-Harris administration should reset relations with Latin America, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts, one of whom, of course, is Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and Miriam Kornblith, Director for Latin America and the Caribbean at the National Endowment for Democracy, also based here in Washington. She has taught politics at the Central University of Venezuela and served as a board member and vice president of the Venezuela National Electoral Council. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks, Carol.
So, Eric, let me start with you. 1 year ago this week, the World Health Organization declared the COVID-19 outbreak a global pandemic. So let's first get a brief update on the COVID pandemic and its impact on Latin America. Are we seeing any improvements? What is your perspective with respect to the health and the economies in the region?
Well, it's great to be with you again, Carol, and your listeners, and to join my good friend Miriam Kornblith. What a privilege to have that opportunity. In brief, the situation is pretty desperate. COVID, for whatever reason, seems to have done more damage to the Western Hemisphere, to Latin America specifically, than to other regions of the world. It's not to minimize what else has happened elsewhere in the world, but Latin America seems to have been hit particularly hard. I think there are a number of reasons for that. We've talked about in previous discussions, but leadership in certain countries, particularly the larger countries that minimize the risk at the beginning and in fact continues to do so, I think has to be put on the table. I think the whole issue of informality in regional economies is really an important point. You can't stay home and quarantine if you have to be out on a daily basis selling artifacts or trinkets or what have you on the street corner just to make a living for your family. You just don't have that option. Connectivity in terms of some of the telecommunications and access to Zoom and to Microsoft Teams and other aspects is not available to everybody. So the economic realities are really important. And I think you also have some issues of just the fact that you have some pretty remote locations around the region where information and misinformation travels, vaccines don't necessarily. It's a really complicated scenario, and the region has suffered significantly. And to put it into economic context, the region last year, 2020, as a result, suffered the worst economic contraction in over 100 years. In fact, since records began to be kept at the beginning of last century. The IMF predicts that a return to pre-pandemic per capita GDP won't occur until 2025. So we've really seen a setback in the region that's going to take a long time to recover. And so if we're looking at it with objective eyes, we have to say that the situation is in pretty bad condition and really needs a reset going forward.
Turning to you, Miriam Kornbluth, what would you like to add or subtract to what Eric just said about the COVID pandemic in the region?
Thanks, Carol. And again, it's a great pleasure to be here with Eric. I fully agree with what Eric has presented, but I think there are different realities in the region as well. I mean, this is like the broad picture, but there are some different cases. Unfortunately, these are the smaller countries, but a good handling of the pandemic in Uruguay, a good handling of pandemic in Costa Rica. And nowadays, in the case of Chile, Chile has surpassed Israel in terms of the per capita vaccination rate. So they're doing a very good job in terms of vaccination. We have very bad cases. The worst is Brazil, indeed, where the figures are just skyrocketing. Brazil at this point has only a few days ago already surpassed 2,700 deaths per day. It's more than 270,000 deaths overall so far. So what we can see, again, within this very broad picture, that there are differences. In some countries, leadership has been much more effective than in others, and leadership matters. I mean, having leaders such as Bolsonaro or López Obrador initially in Mexico just disregarding the dangers and the threat involved in the pandemic had a lasting damaging effect on handling the pandemic from the government side. But on the other hand, I mean, I think that something that Eric mentioned, but I'd like to insist, this pandemic has highlighted the pre-existing conditions, the pre-existing negative conditions, such as access to health and security, safety nets in the region, the widespread informality. All of that has played a very significant role in limiting the positive efforts of some governments, such as in the case of Peru, that really tried to handle the pandemic in a, say, responsible fashion at the beginning. But those pre-existing conditions really worked against that attempt. And on the other hand, leadership has made a difference, and more democratic leaders have had better results in handling the pandemic than less democratic leaders had.
Well, that's a very interesting point, Miriam Kornbluth, because our friend Eric Farnsworth has made that point in previous programs that leadership really matters. So that leads me to ask you about the challenges and opportunities for the Biden-Harris administration insofar as what do you think they can do to bolster these good leaders, these democratic leaders who believe in equity and economic growth and better health and economic and political and social conditions for their people? And where can they perhaps try to provide either incentives or even implement sanctions on those who are not really, you know, helping their people? What do you think, Eric Farnsworth, how can the Biden administration, you know, help the region go forward in a positive way, perhaps differently than the way the Trump administration dealt with the region?
Miriam raised a really important point, and that is that there are broad divergences within the region, and some countries have done better than others. That is absolutely right. And I think that's the first place I would start in terms of a Biden-Harris administration is recognizing that there are differences within the region. There is not a one-size-fits-all approach. And I can say with confidence that they do recognize that. But the first thing that has occurred has been a change in tone, a shift in tone. We've heard nothing about rapists and murderers, for example, and we've heard a lot about partnership and cooperation and mutual agenda and working together. So I think that's the point of departure, and I think it's a very positive one, but of course we have to get to actions then as well. Look, the reality is the entire region is faced with a healthcare crisis of the pandemic, and we have to get beyond that in the first instance. That has to be the top priority. Indeed, it's the top priority in the United States itself, and this is where some of the complication comes in, because the President of the United States, of course, is elected by the people of the United States to focus on the health and well-being of the people of the United States, right? But that runs up against the reality of access to vaccines and the ability of other countries, particularly those in emerging markets that don't produce their own vaccines, to have access to them. And so one would hope, indeed, that as the United States finds rates of vaccinations to be reaching certain thresholds and that certain vulnerable populations are becoming fully vaccinated, that we do find a way somehow to be very generous in the context of getting vaccines into Latin America and the Caribbean in a way that is responsive to the needs of the people of the region. We can see already, for example, that some of the strategic competitors around the world have been doing that, Russia, China, and some others as well. And the fact of the matter is they don't have to put the priority of their own citizens at the same level as a democracy does. And so they can disadvantage their own citizens and frankly have misinformation to their citizens about what the reality is, even as they're exporting vaccines to other communities and countries for their own geopolitical purposes. So there's a mismatch here in terms of what democracies are able to do versus authoritarian countries, and that's a reality. But having said that, we do need to do a better job by messaging to Latin America and the Caribbean, as well as to other emerging markets around the world, that the United States, we're not just a generous country for ourselves, we're a generous country for others around the world. And we have to match that, in my view, with real actions, particularly in terms of vaccine access and availability on a cost-effective way going forward. So that would be the place I would start in the immediate term.
So turning to you, Miriam Kornbluth, your organization promotes democracy and good governance in the region and around the world. How do you think the Biden-Harris administration can accentuate good governance in the region, which would lead to better equity and outcomes in health and economy? And do you see signals from this administration in that regard, whether it be vaccination distribution and other support for health infrastructure and other important issues?
There have been many interesting articles and also documents that the Biden campaign produced during the campaign where they outlined their approach to global matters and specifically to Latin America, which I think are useful. There are three pillars, as far as I understand, they establish as the guiding strategic dimension of their policy for Latin America. The first is cooperation and multilateralism. The second is respect for democracy, rule of law, human rights. The third is climate change. Most of this was written and established prior to the pandemic, and I think that now the pandemic is another pillar. I mean, dealing with the pandemic, not only for the U.S., of course, but for the region, as Eric pointed out. But I think those three elements allow for much more exchange, coalition building, bringing more players into the conversation. I mean, just having a more cooperative and multilateral approach to difficult situations, obviously, such as the Venezuelan, but also to generate opportunities and to make use of opportunities sets a different approach. And of course, having a very clear focus on democracy, rule of law, good governance, human rights also sets a tone and sets priorities and also sets, say, the criteria to identify allies and to be more careful with governments that are not truly democratic or respectful of rule of law. So I think these three principles are very important and can generate a new approach to Latin America and can bring together a broader coalition that includes governments, but also civil society organizations, the media, business sector, with this approach that I think we all agree that is an approach that is mostly shared throughout the hemisphere. And it has been enshrined in the Inter-American Democratic Charter, is where Latin America would like to be in terms of democracy, human rights, rights, good governance. And, you know, one thing that is also disappointing about the region is that having all these regional bodies in Latin America, they have also been very ineffective in dealing with the pandemic. So it's not only individual governments, but also the region as such has failed to address the pandemic from a regional perspective. Maybe with this multilateral approach and knowing that the Summit of Americas will take place probably at the beginning of next year here in the U.S., it could be an opportunity to find ways to engage the regional bodies into addressing not only the pandemic, but in the meantime, I think there are opportunities to start thinking about hemispheric approaches to the pandemic, to the huge migration crisis, that is the development of the Venezuelan crisis. There's also obviously the migration crisis focused in Central America. I think this new perspective will probably provide more elements to address these crises from a more constructive and probably more effective standpoint.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, he's Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and Miriam Kornblith, Director for Latin America and the Caribbean at the National Endowment for Democracy. They join me via Microsoft Teams. We're discussing the dire impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on Latin America and the contours of U.S. policy toward the region under the Biden administration. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Ibrahim Abba from Zaria in Kaduna State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to you, Eric Farnsworth, briefly on Venezuela, talking about a more regional approach or the fact that perhaps the Biden administration may work more closely with our European allies. If we assume that democracy for Venezuela equals the end of the Maduro regime and an ushering in of, let's say, Juan Guaido or Democrats to run the country, what combination of carrots and sticks do you think should be used, and a coalition of countries? And what coalition of countries can best foster it, perhaps with the United States in the lead?
Well, these are really important questions and really involved questions, Carol. Thanks for asking them. You know, yes, I would agree that democracy won't return to Venezuela with Nicolas Maduro still in power there, but I wouldn't assume that his departure will guarantee the return of democracy. So we have to be a little bit careful about that. The situation there is quite bad, and the democratic institutions and, in fact, the muscle memory of democracy across the country has arguably atrophied. And so we have to rebuild it literally at the street level, all the way up to the very top, to the Miraflores Palace. But the Biden administration has come in with a view that the previous approach didn't work. And I think that's self-evident because Nicolas Maduro remains in control and his regime remains in control in Venezuela. But the options really are limited. On December 6th, the legislative elections occurred. And I put elections in quotes because they were not free or fair. The opposition didn't even contest them because they knew that the result was preordained and that the regime candidates would win. And indeed, they did. And what that means is that the national legislature, which had been the last remaining institution of democracy in the country, has now been captured by the Maduro regime. And in fact, all institutions of democracy have been. So we're dealing now with a consolidated dictatorship in Venezuela, and that makes issues that much more complicated. So very briefly, I think there are just a couple things that really do need to occur. The first is we do need to pay attention to the humanitarian crisis. I mean, these are people's lives at stake. So it's not just COVID, it's also basic health and sanitation and food and schooling and all of the rest. And it does affect the neighboring countries very directly. So I think we have to be mindful of that, number one. Number two, we absolutely need to do a better job coordinating with our allies and friends, both in the region as well as Europe. And this is one of the problems of the previous approach. there just wasn't a whole lot of coordination between the United States and some of the other countries. We were going separate directions. Sanctions regimes didn't match up, and the regime was able to play the United States off against our allies, and that made making progress very difficult. So we have to perhaps relaunch an effort with new actors and see where that gets us. But at the end of the day, we really have to be humble in terms of what we can do on the ground in Venezuela. I mean, there's only so much the international community can do. This has to be a Venezuelan effort. I hesitate to go further because Miriam actually is an expert on Venezuela, being a Venezuelan herself and has real expertise here. But from an outsider's perspective, these are some of the things that really do have to be considered.
So, Miriam Kornblith, from a more insider perspective, what else would you add or subtract to the list of measures that outside powers can bring to bear? And what about those inside pressing for democracy? What are they looking for from their regional neighbors, organizations to help them rid themselves of the dictatorship under Maduro?
Well, regarding Venezuelans, I mean, I think, of course, this is the Venezuelan cause and the Venezuelans long for democracy. I think that's the starting point. Despite 20 years of massive propaganda, massive attempts to change people's minds and people's aspirations, Venezuelans nowadays are more convinced than ever that democracy is what they want. And that has been consistent through all these years and even more right now. So I think that's the first aspect we need to highlight. Secondly, the civil society organizations have become very organized, very effective, very strong, very coordinated and articulated, not only domestically, but also internationally. And they have raised the voice of Venezuelans, have raised the humanitarian crisis, the crisis of democracy, and have continued doing that because Venezuelans want democracy. I'm sorry if I'm insisting in this aspect, but I think this is very important. Third, political parties, political players have also had a very critical role in maintaining this longing and this flame of democracy alive in Venezuela. They have participated in elections when elections made sense. They have not participated in elections when elections did not make sense, but always having in mind that elections, peaceful means, institutional means to regain democracy are at the forefront of their aspirations and their struggle. I mean, unlike other countries where oppositions have used the guerrilla path or have tried to contest the government through violent methods, the democratic opposition in Venezuela, which includes civil society and parties, have always sought the institutional electoral path, and that is what they still want. At this moment, I think what's very important is to articulate the efforts of the international community and the Venezuelan democratic forces, democratic players. And they are in perfect sync. What the international community wants is a peaceful, democratic, and electoral path for Venezuela. And that's what domestic forces want. But of course, this is difficult because neither the international community nor the forces in Venezuela are totally uniform, have the exact same point of view. It's difficult to articulate both the international community and the democratic forces inside Venezuela, but also to articulate the two of them to come up with, say, a reasonable and effective path. But overall, I think that sanctions have had a very important impact in weakening the government and also isolating the Maduro government from the democratic international community. On the other hand, going back, looking to elections as the legitimate and sought for path to regain democracy, which is something that both internally and internationally is being repeatedly stated as the desirable way to regain democracy, is also, I think, a very positive and constructive way to address the situation in Venezuela. Continuing with sanctions, but now the administration here is talking about smart sanctions, which means to really emphasize those that have had an impact on weakening the government and also coordinating more with international players on applying and implementing the sanctions, I think continues to be an important element. And the carrots is try to generate in a broader array of players the sense that they can seek office and they can maintain their aspiration of becoming political players through reinstating democracy, the rule of law, and elections in the country.
Well, Miriam, thank you for that. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I would like to thank my guest, guests Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and Council of the Americas, and Miriam Kornbluth, Director for Latin America and the Caribbean at the National Endowment for Democracy. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.